Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Paul Bruhn, and he'll be answering your most important questions on cutthroat on the Upper Snake River. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Paul a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Paul Bruhn about cutthroat on the Upper Snake River. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, in the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their clean angling pledge. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and in doing so, give back something to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. And if you're already a member, go ahead and send them a donation. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Well, before we introduce Paul, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. On our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Paul's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a $20 gift certificate from Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado. And their website is frontrangeanglers.com. Now, here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question's going to be something that Paul and I talk about during the show, so you got to listen carefully and be the first person to answer correctly at the end of the show. And if you are, then you will win that $20 gift certificate, which you can redeem online or in person in their store. Well, tonight our guest is Paul Bruhn. And Paul is a self-taught fly fisherman who learned on the docks, seawalls, and bridges near his childhood home in South Florida. He spotted his father's Montague and South Bend bamboo fly rods in the garage, and they loaded Fugger Medalist, and that was the start of his fly fishing journey. Paul worked at a newspaper during the summers all through college, and he started his career in newspaper in 1969 as editor of the Miami Beach Reporter. He also worked as an editor in the Jackson Hole Guide, Jackson Town Councilman, and as an editor and co-publisher at the Jackson Hole Daily. Today he writes a weekly outdoors column in the JH News and Guide. In 1974, Paul started as a fly fishing outfitter and owner of South Fork Fly Fishing Float Trips and continues to this day taking people fly fishing in the Bridger-Teton National Forest. While guiding on the Snake and other western rivers, he developed a high-performance, low-profile fiberglass drift boat and started manufacturing them through a company he co-owned called South Fork Skiff. Today, he also works as a fly fishing ambassador for Patagonia Outdoor Company. And the pursuit of cutthroat trout in their native habitats is still fascinating to Paul. The Snake River is not stocked, and the reproduction, thanks to improved conditions on river-adjacent spring creeks, continues to sustain a popular, healthy fishery. And that's what's kept Paul rowing boats since 1974. Well, Paul, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Roger, thank you very much. It's fun to be here.
Well, is it a nice day there in South Florida?
Well, it was probably about the same temperature as in Colorado where you were today this morning, and so we decided to take a well-deserved day off and do nothing other than rig and wander around.
Yeah, the weather here, in fact, I had to go down, I'm up in Bailey, Colorado right now, but I had to go down to Denver, and I had the air conditioning on today in Denver. So.
Okay, well, then you would not have been the same. We had the rain and cold weather on today.
Oh, no. It was gorgeous here. But so anyway, Paul's down vacationing when he should be up rowing on the snake, right?
That's probably true. I think that my timing on this one was probably not as good because there were a lot of boats cruising around town when we drove out Friday.
Yeah, people are getting the itch, I think, yeah.
Early in the season, it's very contagious.
Right. Well, we've got lots to talk about tonight, and I know your home water, so to speak, is the snake and the tributaries and so forth around there. So let's just dive into these questions, Paul, and see what kind of damage we can do here. First off, we've got Tad in Noakesville, Virginia, and he asks, how are the cuts related to the more well-known species of trout, and where is their indigenous area? So tell us a bit about the cutthroat.
Well, the cutthroat's pretty interesting for people like Tad. It's a little more well-known in the West, where it is the native fish, as opposed to rainbows and browns, which are what most people think of as the fishery of choice out here. And one of the reasons I enjoy talking about the cutthroat is it's a little bit like Rodney Dangerfield. It doesn't get really the respect I think it deserves. So we like to promote it because it is our native fish in the area, and it's also a spectacularly interesting fish when you see the conditions that it can survive, some of not its own making, and still prevail and reproduce. There are probably, it depends which biologist you're speaking with, but there's probably 14 at least subspecies of cutthroat. They're closest related to the rainbow, which is the West Coast trout, because they're spring spawners. They will go to the ocean as some subspecies of cutthroat out in Seattle coast, and they'll even up as far as Alaska, go out into the ocean and come back in an anadromous mode. There are some what they call the giant cutthroat, which is the Lahontan cutthroat, which was from Pyramid Lake originally on the other end of the Lake Tahoe strain. Biggest cutthroat out of there that they recorded is 41 pounds. Those days are over, and there are still Lahontans around, but that giant strain is pretty much extinct. The cutthroat was left after waters recede, and I'm not much of a geologist, so I can't tell you the various mountains and movements, but the Apache and the Gila trout, which are down in Arizona all the way down to Mexico, are also a very close relative of the cutthroat. So it might not be a well-known species in some places, but in the West, Montana, Colorado, Nevada, Oregon, and Wyoming, Utah, it's a definite native, and the fact that it's still out there in its many forms is, I think, pretty exciting, and it's a story that we like to talk about.
Well, now, I know in reading your bio in the introduction of the show, it said that, then you just said the cutthroat are native to the Snake River. They're native. Are they still wild today, or are they stocked, or they reproduce on their own?
Well, that's a great story, and very specifically in the Snake, which I'm going to call our river, there's two snakes. There's a snake in Wyoming that begins up in the National Forest in the wilderness area outside of Yellowstone, swings into Yellowstone, comes out, comes down through Grand Teton National Park, and then it goes down below Jackson, swings a little to the west, and goes into Idaho. Idaho has the Henry's Fork, or also known as the North Fork of the Snake, and our portion that starts up in the wilderness and goes through Jackson goes into Idaho just below the town of Alpine, and that is known in Idaho as the South Fork. And so you can call it just the Snake in Wyoming, but it's the South Fork and the North Fork, and they come together outside of a town called Rexburg over in Idaho. The North Fork comes in from up by Island Park, and the South Fork comes in from over below Idaho Falls, or on its way to Idaho Falls, and then it heads on across Idaho and runs into the Columbia. The native fish in that river is still self-sustaining, and it is the Snake River cutthroat, which to give you the Latin version of it. It's Oncorhynchus clarkii, and you can get into a lot of different stories about, is it the Yellowstone cutthroat? Is it the Snake River cutthroat? There's one person I know that can give you the answer to that, and he's a geneticist down at BYU named Dennis Shiazawa, and he can tell you the little tiny differences between the Yellowstone and the Snake River. But basically, for our discussion, they're going to be fairly interchangeable, because you're going to just get into a tremendous argument about something that isn't worth getting into. They look a little bit different, but they're basically the Yellowstone, the Snake River cutthroat, we're going to talk about this evening, I hope. We're going to consider it a little bit more like one fish.
Okay, and that was a question Eric from Pennsylvania kind of asked. He said he's fished for Yellowstone cutthroat, and are they similar? So you've kind of answered his question.
Well,
there's
a couple of things in that question that I saw from Eric. A lot of aspects of cutthroat are dictated, as in any trout, by the water that they're in.
Okay.
And our fish, and now I'm going to speak specifically of the fine-spotted cutthroat that comes in the Jackson area, which is kind of indigenous to the spring creeks in Jackson, has a very aggressive tendency, probably a little bit more aggressive than the Yellowstone version that Eric is talking about that lives up in the Yellowstone River itself. And one of the reasons for that, I think, is that the waters that they're in can be classified as just a little bit different. Our river, and again I'm talking about the Snake coming out of the upper Snake, coming down through Jackson, is a very capricious, changeable river. It moves around a tremendous amount. It carries an enormous bed load, and its runoff comes very late. A lot of times our river, people aren't fishing until almost August, when several of the tributaries that go through a lot of unstable property clear up. Well, that won't be the case this year, I think you'll realize. We don't have an abundance of extra snow that's going to make this a long runoff period, unless we have a big, long spring. But, you know, that can happen anytime. But our water blasts along, the river changes, and the fish have to be a little bit more opportunistic because they don't have good holding water. We don't have the rocks in the Snake that the Yellowstone River has in almost any part of it. And so when you have a rocky system and you have a lot more stonefly habitat, a lot different habitat from one that's grinding itself up every year, fish behave differently.
So because of that, you said, you know, you're finding them more opportunistic than the fish, Yellowstone.
I think our fish, if you can put the Snake River and the Yellowstone together side by side, our fish is a pretty aggressive fish.
Okay. That sounds like fun to me, Paul.
Well, it is fun. It's fun particularly when you put the fish into another system, such as, let's say, the Green River down in Utah, where they put a few of them. They've put them down in Thermopolis and the Wind River. They're in the Shoshone River up around Cody, and you'll see a couple of fish, or a little pod of fish, stacked up, let's say, behind a little wing dam or something where the main river's coming by. And invariably, if there's a cutthroat around, and it's a nice cutthroat, he's going to be the first fish in line.
Yeah,
and I've had fellows tell me this from other rivers, and they said, you know, that fish of yours is really pretty aggressive, and so I went over to some of these places just to see it for myself, and it was kind of interesting to see how they take care of themselves. And then if you move this fish down to Arkansas, where you have those wonderful year-round kind of non-polar ice cap conditions, they put on 2.5 pounds a year in that area, and they get really big.
Mm.
The one thing that stops our fish from getting, let's say, as big as some of the other trout of note is that they aren't as long a lived fish. But again, that has to do with the environment that they're in versus, you know, a little nicer type situation. I would hesitate to say how they do if you put them in an idyllic situation such as New Zealand. might really do well. But right now, they're where we are, and we're very, very proud of them.
Well, now, what's a up in the upper Snake there? What's an average size fish that you would catch up there?
According to our local Game and Fish, and I've written about some of this and probably don't keep up with it as much anymore, because when you do a creel census, you get a lot of averages. And the last creel census that I wrote about, they had a hard time finding enough fish to really measure to get an average. But it came out to about 12 and a half inches.
Okay.
So,
and what's a trophy then?
That would not be a trophy, but I can promise you that that's going to pull on you well enough. And some days I'm thrilled with that. And some days I'm a little bit spoiled.
What would be a trophy fish for the...
It depends also, Roger, who's measuring that fish.
I got a couple buddies that their measurements are always longer than mine for some reason.
Yeah, they somehow get more 18s and 20s than we do. And so I'm going to say that they would do very well in Jackson. They would probably have a lot of trophy fish. But if you get a 17, 18, 19-inch fish in our river, you've got something that's very special fish. That you get one over 20, and you've really done something.
Wow. Okay. Good.
And
good.
That's not to say that there aren't probably a few more of them around, but you just don't always see them.
Right. Right. Now, are there any other kinds of fish in the Snake? Are there rainbows
yes.
or browns?
Well, I'm going to say that the majority fish in our river is the Snake River cutthroat. We get some browns. The browns were introduced into our system in Yellowstone in Lewis Lake in 1890. And they have migrated downstream. They're a lot more of a presence in the Idaho portion of the South Fork of the Snake than they are in our presence. And that is to say, you're not going to catch them in our section. There's some right below the Jackson Lake Dam is probably the place where you would catch the most browns. There's some lake trout that were also introduced at about that time. They will pop up in the river. Again, going out through the dam, and they don't really do very well in the river. And the browns have never established themselves in our portion of the Jackson Hole Snake. They're there. You'll catch one or two or maybe three, but you're not going to see them. And there's some brook trout that have been around from a long time ago that are in some of the ponds and some of the spring creeks. They pop up in the river from time to time, and there is a residual population of rainbows that were stocked in the Grovant back, I'm going to say, in the 50s. It's in Grant Hagen's book about stocking, and the one I found in the library had the section chopped out with a razor blade, but there was stocking in the Grovant, which is a tributary just up above the town of Jackson. And they've stayed pretty much in the Grovant. Occasionally one will pop up. I've caught one rainbow in many years down in the Whitewater Canyon. But mostly it's a cutthroat unique fishery.
Okay. We did have a question that came in on the Internet here from Jake in Swan Valley, Idaho. And he was asking, you know, do you think the rainbow are impacting the habitat of the cutthroat?
Boy, that's a real tight question for somebody such as myself, because the rainbows have gotten a big leg up in the South Fork in Idaho. And as you may or may not know, there have been petitions against the various management agencies that handle cutthroat, all the many species of cutthroat in Colorado, in Idaho, even Nevada, about threatening to put it on the endangered species list. There are several cutthroat that are on the threatened list, including the Lahontan. But in the area over in Idaho, they've had a number of, hopefully this is over for a little while, a number of drought years. The rainbows can spawn in the river, whereas cutthroat are more of a tributary spawner. And they had some rainbows get up into the tributaries, and so we've done some funding through various private organizations and some public groups, the state game and fish departments, to try to seal off these areas from rainbow intrusion so that you lose the integrity of your cutthroat fishery, which would then, I think, you would end up with federal action. And as far as the health of the fishery, that's the tricky part, is that Idaho now has put no limit in the Swan Valley area where the gentleman sent the question. There's no limit on catching of rainbows, and the season is open year-round. Now, it's a catch-and-release fishery for cutthroat. The fact that some people can't tell the difference, that's a little bit of a problem, but usually the people that are looking for a mess of rainbows, they've got a pretty good idea what they look like. And there are some people working to keep them, and yet you'll find some beautiful rainbows over there, and it's hard for a guy who's used to catching a trout and letting them go to say, well, I'm just going to kill this fish and take it home, knowing that if they do take it home, they aren't going to be facing any kind of social stigma. It's part of the recommended management program. Right now, the cutthroat have made a very nice comeback, and we've had some good water years, so the cutthroat spawning has been enhanced. In those really low water years, the stress is on tributary spawning is pretty hard, and the rainbows got way ahead of everybody. But right now, I sometimes am very happy those rainbows are in there when I'm having a struggle of a day and the cutthroat are shutting me down. I can sometimes back into a rainbow and make something happen. But right at this moment, I think things are in pretty good shape.
Okay. Well, Paul, we need to take a quick break here, but when we come back, we'll talk more with Paul about cutthroat in the Upper Snake River. Royal Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They provide both walkway and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas, South Platte, and several private high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado. Located conveniently on US 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's royalgorgeanglers.com. Or call them at 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Paul Bruin about cutthroat on the Upper Snake River. If you'd like to ask Paul a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. And use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately. We'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Paul, tell us just a bit about what's going on in your fly fishing world. Are you still guiding? I know you're still writing. Tell us what's happening.
Roger, it's very simple. I'm sitting here waiting for the season to start, and as we've intoned earlier, it's probably going to be started before we even get back to Jackson. But fishing season, if you're a fishing outfitter, it can start with the weather and the fish and everything going fine. You have to have a few people to take. And our fishermen that come to Jackson are usually used to a little more of a laid-back summer. They don't try to get started too early because we can have runoff. There's other rivers that they'll fish if they're in Jackson because it's a very convenient area to go. But the Snake, this year is probably going to be fishing, I'm going to go out on a little bit of a limb and say probably by late June and easily July, early July. I'm pretty sure that it'll be ready to go. The thing that we've been doing is I have a very small guiding operation and don't spend a lot of time trying to promote guiding or lots of trips. I try to have people that find us and you know, they either want to have a day full of great stories and get their ears worn out, or they want to just fish very hard and try to learn a little bit about some of the things that we enjoy doing on the river. I did add a significant change to my, my guiding operation. In last August, I got married to a lovely woman who has a lot of guiding expertise down in your part of the world, down in Colorado. Her name is Jean Williams, and so she has been busy learning the snake for about the last 4 years, and it's been a real pleasure to say, I can't go, but I'd like you to go with my wife or maybe a couple other fellows that we think are pretty good. So that's basically what we're going to do. I'm going to have we hope a pretty good summer this year. I'm expecting it. And I think that, I know Gene's very enthused about it. So that's basically what we're doing. We fish usually into mid-October. And again, you're taking a little bit of a chance with weather, but at the same time, there's a lot less people around. The water can be a lot lower, and the fishing is really, really fun. And lately, the weather hasn't been too threatening, so we get some pretty good fishing from mid-September right on into at least mid-October.
And Paul, if someone wanted to chat with you about a potential trip or something, how would they get a hold of you?
Well, we try to keep that as big a secret as possible. That way, we don't have to say no to anybody. But I've been in the phone book for about 36 or 37 years.
Okay.
And they can just email me. It's a pretty simple email. It's Paul Bruhn, B-R-U-U-N, at WYOM.net.
Okay, great. Great. Mm-hmm. And Kip in Denver wants to know who's the better guide, you or Gene?
That's very simply answered in that people that have gone with me for a long time will say, well, we'd like to do a day with Gene, and that's the last I see him. They go, are you kidding me? She's never met anybody that she didn't like, and she's so nice to people, and she really gets them to catch fish. And of course, she's fairly enthusiastic, too. So
does she make better sandwiches than you?
Oh, she's in the market earlier than I am.
That's important, those sandwiches, you know. So.
They might have to endure a little bit of celery and a few more carrots than they
Oh, those darn veggies, huh?
But yeah, she likes a rounded diet, stresses a rounded diet for me. But she has a lot more snacks than I do.
Oh, okay. All right, well, let's get back into the fishing here. Joe in Tennessee wants to know, are there any disease problems with the cuts on the Snake River?
Boy, I'm sitting at a beautiful wooden desk, and I'm going to say, knock on wood, we have been fortunate. And I don't think that there's anything of major problem right now in our portion of the Snake River. We dodged a bullet with whirling disease, and that's not to say that cutthroat aren't susceptible to that, but we don't have in our part of the river a lot of tubiflex worms and that silt. Most of that stuff gets blown out, and we send that to Idaho and on out to the Columbia as early as we can every year. So we haven't been bothered with it. There's been a little bit of whirling disease discovered in some of the little tributaries in a nearby drainage, but it hasn't been anything that's really gotten going. So
Good.
I think we've been very fortunate. We've got a little group in Jackson that's been very active with trying to keep a lot of the other invasives out as far as the healthy river.
Right.
And that's, I think, everybody's biggest problem now is to try to clean their stuff up and be respectful of everybody else's water as well as your own.
It was interesting. I was listening to National Public Radio the other day, and it was a piece they were doing on caves down in Missouri.
Uh-huh.
And they have evidently a ton of caves down there. And they have a similar problem with the spelunkers going into caves and bringing certain kinds of spores in that affect the bats there. So, you know, it's just kind of interesting to me that they have a similar problem that fly fishers have of man taking, you know, these animals into other areas and establishing them and screwing things up.
It seems like we don't make things much better with our presence.
And every time we try it, it gets worse, right?
Right. But then you have to go back to a point where penicillin hasn't been a bad addition. So
yeah, that's right. That's
occasionally
right.
We do something right. But I think that a lot more people are getting very, very sensitive to what we're speaking about, and at least I sure hope so.
Yeah.
Because you just move around too much now.
Right. Now, I've got a question that came in on the Internet. Mike Wolf in Williamsport, Pennsylvania asks, do cuts inhabit headwaters out west, similar to brookies in the east?
Well, that's a great question, and let's put it this way. The brook trout is a very, very cold water fish. And a cutthroat is, he can survive in very cold water, but he doesn't seek it out and try to go in there. And a lot of fish, and I'll know more about this because they've just done a very big radio tagging study on some of our fish. We've done them in the past, and they find out that a lot of our fish are real vagabonds, and I hope I remember to tell you about one specific aspect of that that I find very interesting. But they don't try to go up to the coldest part of the stream. They're going to drop back, especially because a lot of our places, we don't have the number of spring creeks in our area that they do in a lot of other places with the big flows. So a lot of the tributaries where they will hang out and spawn get pretty lean in the wintertime. And so they're going to drop out of there because of predation. I mean, we've got a lot of things that like cutthroat, from otters and mink to a lot of the birds and things like that. So they're going to stay out of those smaller little places if they can get to a relative safety of a little bit deeper water and maybe a little more adjustable current through depth.
Okay. We've got Reed in Swan Valley. Now, what is Swan Valley, just over the border? In
Swan Valley is just downstream from the Palisades Dam.
Okay. He says he hears that the Idaho Fish and Game have marked rainbow trout on the snake with monetary rewards to encourage people to keep the rainbows they catch. I know you just said it was a take-and-keep kind of situation. But he asked, do you have any insights on this subject? Have you heard about this monetary reward?
I had heard just a tiny bit about it, but the fisheries gentleman that I knew over in Idaho transferred out to someplace else, and I have not kept up with what they're doing. I can go ahead and try to find out when I get back up there.
Yeah, yeah.
But I know that they're pretty serious about it.
Yeah.
They're serious about it for a number of reasons. First of all, I don't think that Idaho wants to be in a situation where somebody can label them as being soft on invasive species, and thereby we want to make your fish, your native fish, a endangered species. I think that would be a very big hardship for them. And number two, I know that there's a lot of people from, let's just say, very old-time fish-keeping areas that have been encouraged to come up to the South Fork and do some fishing, and these guys do want to take home some fish, and I don't think that you have to encourage them too much more.
Yeah,
so I think
yeah.
Things are evening out.
Okay, okay. We got a question on the Internet here from Dan Kiefer in Rochester, Michigan. He says, what are your views on the efforts to restore cutthroat populations in some watersheds or sub-watersheds? Can these efforts be more than just remnant populations? Also, once other trout get established into a cutthroat watershed, do you think the cutthroat can hold its own? For example, Yellowstone National Park, rainbow trout in Slough Creek, and lake trout in Yellowstone Lake.
That's a great question, and it comes right out of recent articles that have been written in several of the magazines, Slough Creek and up in Icebox Canyon above there on another creek, and I can't quite remember the name of it. But there's a lot going on with trying to reduce the competition from rainbows in some park waters. The lake trout issue in Yellowstone Lake is a big one, and very frankly, those are more biology and real expert questions. Remember, I'm just a fishing guide. I'm not a policy maker.
Yeah.
And I know one thing, that when you take a system that you have, such as our system, and I mentioned it earlier, there's rainbows in the Grovant, but you don't see many rainbows in the Snake River itself. There's been brown trout in that in our system for well over 100 years. You don't see many brown trout other than the occasional one. Now, that tells you what fish is suited to our system.
Right.
And so they're trying to keep the Bear River strain of trout down in the Cokeville-LaBarge Creek area, and they're trying to keep our original Colorado cutthroat moving along in the Daniel and up in the Cottonwood Creek area down off the Green, and the Green was an all-Colorado cutthroat fishery originally. To try to return it to a Colorado cutthroat trout fishery, A, would get a lot of people very upset, and B, it would be very expensive to do it.
Uh-huh.
So where you can make this change and add the fish that was the native fish there, I think it's wise. But I think trying to turn the clock back in some places, I think that's very difficult. And,
yeah.
and some
okay.
of those were very pointed questions about Yellowstone, and you don't have enough time on there, and I'm not smart enough to really go into all the intricacies of it, because those are dandy questions.
Well, let's move on and talk about catching some of these cuts. Tim in Illinois asks, is there any specialty gear needed for fishing this river, fishing the snake? And maybe you could just kind of go into, you know, weight rods and lines that you would suggest people coming
okay,
out
and
with.
There's a follow-up to that one, is what weight rod would
right.
you suggest? I'm a little bit heavy-handed, and I'll tell you why. Is I've always watched, our fish doesn't jump, and hence why I don't think as many people are excited about the cutthroat as they could be, but it does pull, and it uses the current to its best advantage. And I have watched too many people with small rods try to teach our fish how to swim, and they swim just fine. Now, there's a lot of fellows today that love four-weight rods, and I'm not diminishing a four-weight or a three-weight rod, because in the hands of somebody who's very good at it, it's fine. But you end up spending a little longer with the fish than I like to do. And I like to be able to control the fish and get it in and release it as quickly as possible and move on down the river. I don't want to stay in one place and just pound it. I want to keep going and, you know, be able to try some different things. So if I had to pick a rod, well, the rod that I use is usually a 9 or 9.5 foot 6-weight rod. And that's for dry fly fishing. If I'm going to fish with wet flies or streamers and heavier stuff in heavier water, we have a very nice little whitewater section that we fish quite a bit. And I like a 7-weight rod in there. Again, if you're using that kind of tackle, which may seem very heavy to somebody from Pennsylvania or Illinois or someplace that is used to a little lighter rod, try not to put a too heavy a reel on them. I find that that really makes a difference. And underlining, overlining, you can discuss that all you want. I usually tend to overline, because with most of the rods today, they're pretty fast. And if I have a 6-weight rod, a 6.5-weight line is pretty good on it. And so I oversimplify things. Just about every fly reel I have for my guide rods has got a 6-weight line on it.
And primarily floating lines for the most part?
Primarily floating lines, especially for most of the year, because people cast a floating line a lot better. It's a lot easier to cast. They don't get as tired. And if you need to get underwater, we've got flies that will get down in the short period of time that they're going to be in the water. So sinking lines, while I love sinking lines, I don't bring them out until pretty specific situations a little later on.
Yeah, I think we got a question later on about that, so we can
okay.
talk about that. What about leader and tippet? Anything special there? Any kind of rig you like?
One of my friends that owns a fly shop in Jackson, I asked him one day, what tippet have you got on? He's a fellow that came up with a fly called the JJ Special, which is a kind of a combination woolly booger and a rubber legs fly in yellow and brown with some tinsel on it. And it's the JJ Special because his name is Jim Jones. And so I said, Jimmy, what pound leader you got on that thing? And he turned around and he said, Weed Eater. And,
Weed Eater. Oh, my God.
I go for
That's
heavy
That's about 200-pound test, isn't
yeah,
it?
I go for heavy stuff, Roger, because I don't like leaving flies in trees or in fish. And if you take a look at some of these nylons today, when I started out, 3X was down in the 2 and 3 pound category. Now it's over 8.5. But I basically, if we're fishing, let's say, a big foam fly, I'm probably going to use at least 2X and maybe 3X to the fly just so it doesn't twist the leader up in the air. And if I'm using that heavy a leader, I'm going to use a loop knot so that the fly will float a little bit freer. Basically, a small dry fly, and by small I mean 14, 16, I'm going to be at 4X. And if I'm using a nymph dropping off, I'll go from 4X to 5X for a couple of reasons. One, it's going to sink a little bit faster with a lighter leader on it. And two, it's probably going to float a little bit better, too. So
okay.
I try to let the leader match the size of the fly so I don't end up with a too big a tangle.
Okay. We have Kevin in Wilson, Wyoming, and Kevin asks, please offer some ideas on types of flies that you find most important by season and any specific techniques for fishing them. So maybe you could kind of briefly walk through the seasons and what we've got hatching on the river there.
All right. Well, one of the interesting parts about our river is that early in the year, we have some fairly good hatches, both midges and some little blue-wing olive-type flies. And there are a series of stoneflies from small to a little bit larger that a lot of people are kind of surprised at. So I'm not going to go into the detail of a super deal, but if you were fishing right now, you could start out fishing small mayflies on probably 5X and some midges. Maybe if you wanted to fish 6X or just under the surface, you could do that if you could find some rising fish towards the middle of the day. This is not going to be river-wide. You're not going to put on and float an 8 or 9 or 10-mile section river if you could get that kind of access and just fish a number 18 parachute Adams. You're going to go to a place, wait for the hatch to start, and then fish it and then move on. If you wanted to cover the water, you would probably fish a little bit bigger fly. We have some very small blackstone flies that come out early. And then we do have some of the squalus stoneflies that are coming out, usually a little bit later in April and into May if the runoff doesn't catch up with us. Of course, when things clear, July, the water's probably a little bit higher then, and most of the people are fishing bigger flies. And that's just out of necessity when you've got 4,000 CFS ripping by. You're not going to be throwing out a number 14 pale morning dun and doing all that well with it, I don't think. So they'll go with the bigger flies. Our grasshoppers don't really get going until a little bit later on, although I've seen grasshoppers in April and May out there. One of the flies that's really a stalwart for us in the summertime, Roger, is a little fly that comes from a stonefly that comes out at night. It's a nocturnal stonefly. And it starts in usually early to mid-August and goes all the way to almost the end of September. And it's about the size of a grasshopper. It has a darker body. It's light sensitive, so you don't see them around very much. And the males don't have wings, and the males run around on the surface, and actually the females do too sometimes, but they do fly. And when that flies on, that's when people say, boy, we're having great hopper fishing. That's not always the case, but it's close enough that when the foam fly activity is going on with kind of a tan body, which is a lot of the summer, it's because that little stone fly is real, real active.
They get keyed in on that, and so
right.
The hopper pattern kind of works.
The hopper pattern kind of works.
Yeah.
On the South Fork, the hoppers are a little bit different colored in some places than they are over on our section of river, and that's sometimes a daily thing. I mean, it's kind of funny, but it is. As the water starts coming down, as the tributaries start losing a little bit of water towards September and then into October, you can still do the terrestrial deal, but then the time for real fishing starts where you're going to go back to the olives and there's still some caddis around. In the evening, you'll see some spinner falls on certain days. And it can get really two small flies in October and well into November. Now, my choice of fishing, I don't fish with clients. I don't fish the streamers as much. There's quite a lot of enthusiasm into throwing streamers, and I think we talked about early in the conversation about the aggressiveness of this fish. And they will chase a streamer. And I've caught cutthroat with salamanders in them. I've caught them with whitefish in them. I've caught them with other trout in them. They're pretty aggressive fish. So the double bunny, which is a fly designed by a young fellow in Jackson named Scott Sanchez, is a big double hook deal that could, you could use it in any saltwater venue there is, and it would not be too big. And you throw that out there, and a lot of times cutthroat will attack it. By the same token, on a given day, you can be fishing big streamers and know that that's what you want to fish, and a guy comes in and fishes a pheasant tail nymph, just swings it around in the current a little bit and starts bringing fish out of 10 feet of water. So that's, I think, one of the beauties of our fishery, at least my observations have been such, is that on a given day, you hear a lot about, let's do this hatch or let's be here for this. And the snake can prove just a little daunting when it comes to being as predictable as you'd like it to be.
Okay. We need to take a quick break again, Paul. So when we return, we'll talk more about cutthroat on the Upper Snake River. Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. And you can view there their fishing products, guide services that they offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. That's dryflies.com. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Paul Bruin about cutthroat on the Upper Snake River. If you'd like to ask Paul a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Now, Paul, there is a question that came in, and this kind of relates to what you were just talking about, but Mike, again, in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, says, do cuts become very selective when there's a specific hatch, or can they be fooled by attractor patterns? And I guess he's referring to during a hatch.
That's a great question, and I may not be the best guy to answer it because I would never be accused of being a super selective trout expert. And as a matter of fact, my friends, quite a few of them joke about that. They say, oh, that can't be Paul Bruin over there. The splash isn't big enough on the cast. So I do have friends that are pretty good at the selective stuff. So I've been fortunate to be with them. One of them is a young man named Rene Harrop, who lives over in Idaho and is really one of the pioneers with no hackle flies, and I mean, if a trout eats it, Rene has probably figured it out. And I've sat with Rene one afternoon and showed him a few fish that he wanted to catch, and he turned after a while and he said, you know, he says, these aren't quite as easy as they're supposed to be. So yes, they can get real picky. And as a fellow that got me started many years ago used to say, you know, he says, a cutthroat is always talked about as though they're kind of stupid and they're not very selective. But he says, I can show you a few that are going to be just a little picky about what they're not going to be selective about. And in a lot of our waters, what you can do, and you can do this with just about any trout and sometimes just about any fish, is your first cast is the money cast. And if you throw a great big fly into a fish that's sitting over in the corner sipping down midges or blue-wing olives or, you know, some other dandruff-sized food, he might just crush that fly. But that's going to be the only one that happens to. After that, they can get very specific and very selective. And it's kind of fun to watch people that are a little bit snobby about their fishing start wiggling around and start getting refusals from these plain old cutthroats. So I think when you get them into a spring creek environment, they can really have you talking to yourself.
Okay, good. Yeah, because when you say aggressive, you think, oh, well, they're just going to hit anything, but not the case.
Well, that isn't always the case.
Yeah. We've got a question from Norman in Ireland, and he asks, not having fished for cutthroats before, I'm wondering how suitable my fly box contents are. How would you describe the difference between browns, rainbows, and cutthroat from the point of considering which are the effective fly patterns to use?
Well, I can't give him too much because I've only been in Ireland to drink a couple of Guinnesses, and I can't talk too much to his fishing, but I know that they do have some brown trout over there. And what I've found, Roger, with just about anybody, and I've taken some wonderful fishermen from the UK fishing, I hope that doesn't annoy a fellow from Ireland by using UK in a generic term like that, but I find that you do well with what you fish well with. If you've got confidence, I took a gentleman from London one time, and he had a little tiny box with a wonderful antiquated fly from that era of his era of fishing, and he was a lot older than I was at the time, and he pulled out a little Tups. Well, it worked just beautifully. And I think it was a combination that he had tremendous confidence in it. He'd used it everywhere. So it was going to work. But if anything, our fish are a little bit more like a brown trout in that they are, I think, a little more omnivorous. Rainbow is a fast water, heavy water fish that really is insect oriented. And because our waters are so different where the cutthroat is, we don't have that, let's say, a Madison River total bank-to-bank bug-producing, fish-holding water. We have specific areas where our fish are located. And if you start to understand cutthroat, you understand that a cutthroat, if you really want to catch cutthroat, you have to understand current, because cutthroat read current better than any fish there is. And the reason I say that is the cutthroat I'm familiar with are just in a little bit off-speed current. Now, you can catch them in super fast water. They'll come blowing out of places you wouldn't think anything could hold in. But by and large, the cutthroat that I've gotten to really appreciate are the ones that they're very thrifty in where they sit. They aren't going to be where the rainbows are, because the rainbows are in the heaviest, most oxygenated water. And the cutthroat isn't going to sit in that except to use it as shelter down on the bottom. He is going to come up along the edges of places like that. And he's going to hold where he can make a living on both insects, on terrestrials, and on minnows and sculpins and things like that. So I think that that gentleman from Ireland, he would have some of those cool lake flies. He'd have some of his little wet flies. I think he'd probably make a pretty good showing wherever he was. But I think if he would think a little more brown trout, he would be a little bit more in step with a cutthroat fishery.
Okay. Well, we've brought up streamers a couple times, and we do have a couple questions. We got one online here and then one that was sent in earlier. Bill in Boulder Junction, Wisconsin says, Paul, are you ready for more muskies? You must have gone fishing for muskies.
Right, Bill Shearer, he's a terrific fellow, an awful lot of fun, and he does know something about streamers.
Yeah, and he says, what's the largest streamer that you use, and what's your favorite streamer pattern?
Well, again, I mentioned it before, I don't favor throwing the great big streamers for a couple of reasons. One, it tears up a lot of fish. And two, when I've been in a jam, I've had, just for fun, had a guy put on one of Sanchez's giant double bunnies and throw it out, and sometimes it just got clobbered the second it hit the water. But giving the average person or the average client something like that to throw, it's going to exhaust the client sooner than it's going to exhaust the fish. And so he's not going to have as much fun lobbing it around, and so I try to get a more manageable fly. If I had to pick a fly, I love stuff like muddler minnows. I really like a black muddler that I've been using quite a little bit. I think that the yellow, kind of a sculpin-like fly that Kelly Gallup came out with called the Zoo Cougar, it works very, very nicely. I like a black and brown, just a woolly booger kind of a fly. And I'll take a kind of a brown rabbit fur, Matuka style, kind of a tied down fly. That's it. And I'm going to go with mostly sixes, eights, maybe a four. And if I just really want to see if I can bring up something. If the fish are really moving, maybe go to a two. But that would be just myself, and I'm probably not going to do it.
Okay. Reed in Swan Valley asks, is the snake a better dry fly or streamer fishery?
That's the best question of the evening, Roger. And I'm going to preface this by saying when I started, and the first trip I took on the snake was in 1974 for a group that was out of the West Coast, and it was managed by a gentleman who had fished everywhere, and he had a hat full of the biggest, baddest-looking streamers you've ever seen. I mean, just massive sculpins and bucktails and great big marabous. And yet he forbid any of his direct staff to fish with anything but a dry fly. And he kind of let it be known that I should not be fishing as many wet flies as I was with my clients. So I said to him one day, Jack, I said, I'm curious, you got all those great big streamers in your hat. What's the deal with your dry fly routine? Because I was thinking he was behaving a little bit too, shall we say, elitistly. And he said, Paul, this fish is such a classic rising fish that you're really wasting a lot of your fishing time and ability if you don't let it showcase what it does well. And that's making that big, slow, careful rise. Well, Roger, it took me about 20 years to really figure out what Jack Weber had told me that day. He was the manager, the West Coast manager of Kaiser Steel. But it's finally come around, and I see fellas out there fishing with the great big streamers. I see them out there with the strike indicators and the nymphs and the everything in between. And I thought, really, if you want to see a cutthroat in the Snake River perform to its best, you wait there and watch it come up. It'd be like saying to Peyton Manning, okay, you can only throw two passes in the first half. You want to see what that fish can do. And believe me, when it comes to looking you off and making you feel kind of silly, the cutthroat will come up so slowly, especially the ones down in Swan Valley, that you have every opportunity to pull the fly away, screw up, miss the strike. And it's just like a giant swooping changeup. You say, I'm going to knock this out of the park, and you're about 3 seconds off of it. So that's...
A dry flies, huh?
Okay. I think if you want to do it, I think that's the fun way to do it.
Yeah, yeah. We need to take another quick break here, Paul, but we'll be right back, so stay with us, folks. Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you will sight fish for big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as a seasonal snook and tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area, and it shows in his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters now and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321-631-4051, or go to his website at flatstime.com. That's FLATSTIME.com, flatstime.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Paul Bruin about cutthroat and the Upper Snake River. If you'd like to ask Paul a question, just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. Receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Paul, we've got a few more. Let's see here. Justin from Logan, Utah, asks about the stonefly hatch up on the snake. You had mentioned it a little earlier, but it didn't sound like it was that big a deal there. Is it a big deal on the snake?
Okay, well, there's a couple of different aspects of stonefly hatch. The normal hatch that we have in the snake comes in about June to early July. Now, that would be the very big stoneflies, and that would be the Acrinuria. We have some, what they call the Pteranarcissus, which is the very biggest western stonefly. Normally, when those flies are coming off on our section of the river's dirty. Down below, right around the end of June, 4th of July, the big stoneflies start on the South Fork, down on the lower river, down in the area from what they call, say, Lorenzo, even below that in Manan. And they'll move up the river, they'll skip sections, and you will have not only the big stoneflies, you'll have golden stoneflies, you'll have the, it's a great little fly, which people call a yellow Sally. It's an Isoperla mormoni. It's a little yellow Mormon girl stonefly that's got a little hint of red in it. And you'll have PMDs, you'll have caddis. And one of the beauties of that whole situation is you'll come around a corner and here'll be a great big fish sitting in a little reversal sipping on pale morning duns, and you throw a stonefly in there and he either clobbers it or he doesn't even look at it. So there's a lot of things going on. But the big stonefly hatch is usually on the South Fork, getting up into Swan Valley around the 13th to the 18th and 20th. And it hangs around for a while. It jumps around. Cold days will come in, some winds, some rain, hail. It'll knock it back. But that's the big stonefly hatch. The hatch that I was referring to comes a little later in the summer, and it's a lot more subtle. And that's the what they call the summer stonefly. It's called a Clycinia sabulosa. And it's not the major event that has 70 or 80 boats in one area floating around and pounding away. But we do have that. And this year might be a good year for people if they're really interested in trying to catch the stonefly. The stonefly is a little bit like the Blarney Stone and seeing a leprechaun. You can put a lot of effort. I thought that was apropos for today, didn't you?
Yeah, there you go.
You can put a lot of effort into finding it or seeing it or participating with it, and you're going to come up a little short a lot of the times. You're going to just be in one wrong section, or you're going to hit the daylights out of it.
Yeah, yeah. All right, let's kind of finish off our fly talk here with a question from Kevin in Wilson, Wyoming. And I don't know if everybody's familiar with the One Fly Tournament that happens up in Jackson, but his question is, if you're entering the One Fly Tournament, what fly are you going to select? And not to get into detail on the One Fly, but it's basically you have one fly to fish all day, correct?
Yes.
So he wants to know which fly you're picking for the day.
Okay. It's probably going to be a little bit area-specific, because now you can practice your area before you go in the one fly. It didn't used to be like that. If I were up way high on the river, up in the slow water, up by the dam on Jackson's side, I would probably go with some sort of a small hopper. If I were down below that and it were possibly a rainy or a drizzly or a cold, snowy day, I would go with some sort of a mayfly, because that's going to get some mayfly activity and possibly what they call the big red quill that comes out, or I'm not sure the ephemerella part of it, but it's called a hecuba. It's a great big dry fly about the size of a green drake. Down below that, fellows get away with real small little hoppers that can be moved around. I happen to like myself flies that induce a lot of movement, so I'm probably going to go with some sort of Western Coachman type of a fly that I can probably move around a little bit, maybe sink it if I have to get down and cover some water, fishing it a little bit wet. And if I got way down into the canyon, I'd probably go with a little bit bigger dry fly of some sort that I could definitely float and move around.
Okay.
But I think that the one fly has really ushered in a lot of creativity, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, yeah. Probably do a whole show on just that.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Well, let's talk about a little bit about the river here. I'm looking at a map now, and I'm my question to you is, what area or stretch do you normally fish with your clients? And I'm thinking if you could maybe kind of describe, you keep saying below the dam, and I see the river goes down through from up in Teton down to Wilson, and then you've got South Park, and then I guess the canyon, is that what you're calling it?
Right. Well, yeah. Let's put it this way. You can start up at the dam, which is the Jackson Lake Dam. It's not really a tailwater because that dam isn't that tall, so the water's coming almost straight out of the lake. We've got a lot of water in the lake, so it's going to be a little bit cooler water up there this year. My fishing normally starts at about the South Park Bridge, and I call that the lower river. It's under the management of the U.S. Forest Service. The Bridger-Teton National Forest manages that. And I fish from there down to an area called Sheep Gulch, which is the bottom of the whitewater section. Now, a lot of people call that kind of the canyon. There's only about 7.5 miles of real whitewater canyon in that. But it doesn't have, that section of river does not have the braiding, the twisting, the side channels, the brush piles that are noticeably present from Pacific Creek down to Dead Man's Bar. This is all in the park. Dead Man's Bar to Moose, Moose to Wilson, and Wilson to South Park. Those are all very multi-channel places with a lot more room to go out and walk around, little channels and even smaller channels.
Yeah, you can see this. I'm looking at a 3D map on the internet, and it just shows incredible braiding going on through
right.
that area. Yeah,
and it's incredible braiding. It's some of it can be a little bit tricky to operate, especially in the early part of the year when a lot of the banks are being undercut and eroded by heavy flows. Trees will fall. I mean, you could be running a float trip one morning and come back that afternoon and go through the same channel and it's blocked.
Yeah.
So as you get to be my age, you don't look for more excitement in the day. So I try not to make it any more exciting than it already is. But down in our section, it's kind of a sweepy float along area. One of the intriguing parts about it is that while you're looking at it, and most everybody when they're float fishing says, well, let's just fish the bank along here. And in many cases, the fish are not on the banks. The fish are laying off, they're on ledges, they're on drop-offs, they're on specific current lines. And so until you start to understand that little section of river, it's about a 25-mile section of river. When you start picking that apart, you'll start finding fish that you were ignoring for a long time.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so that's where I spend most of my my days.
Treg in Moscow asks, can you tell him about the floatability of the water, put-ins and take-outs, shuttle costs, and difficulty of rowing? Would a pontoon boat be okay?
That would be a whole show of its own.
Yeah.
I would say that the Moose to Wilson section, they sank a few boats in there last year, and that's one that I'm not sure I would just go out and do if I weren't a pretty good boater, and I might stop in a few places and look ahead, especially earlier in the year when things are really going on. Wilson South Park has a lot of traffic, both commercial and private, and I think most people can get down through that, but you don't want to go there on your first trip. You want to take something a little bit more relaxing, and I think I'd recommend the lower river, not the whitewater section, but the lower river just to kind of get an idea of where these fish are and get your floating in order. I think that's the best information I could give. I mean, you have a lot of people that tell you when you're going to go skiing with them, well, I'm an intermediate skier,
right?
Or I'm an expert skier. Well, the same holds true with fly fishing, and it definitely holds true with boating skills.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
And
yeah.
So I'm a little leery to give people advice as to what they can and can't do.
We have another question about that. Scott in Oregon asks about
floats from Palisades Dam below the canyon. Is that okay for intermediate rowers? Now, Palisades, is that's below the whitewater
section?
That would be
in Idaho.
Oh, in Idaho. Okay.
That is a lot bigger water. That's probably three times the size of our river. And it can have, I've been in there at 21, 22,000 CFS. And that's going to toss you around. I don't care how good you are. And I had a pretty good sized boat when I was doing that. So I think a lot of that has to do with time of year. That's usually really rolling in June and July.
Okay.
And then it starts to come down a little bit. Now, last year, down in the lower part of that, at Twin Bridges, there was only one way to get through Twin Bridges, and it was a pretty dangerous area. Below that, the year before, there had been an area that was pretty narrow, and it caused people some trouble. So when you go, it's a good idea to talk to the shops. They're going to know pretty well exactly what's going on because it's still March, and if that fellow shows up in July, what I say now may not be appropriate at all.
Sure,
but
sure.
If he can float in Oregon, I'm going to bet that he's not going to have too much trouble.
Yeah, yeah.
He's not going to have too much trouble in the snake.
Jim in Casper, Wyoming asks, is it possible to wade fish on the snake, or do you have to be in a boat in order to stay off private property? So,
well, coming from central Wyoming, he's probably very familiar with the private property situation.
Like
I'm not
going
to say that it's a lot more different, except that in Grand Teton National Park, there are some areas where he can't wade because of eagle closures up until early August. But it's not an issue like he's used to on the Platte. Below that, Wilson to South Park and Moose to Wilson, if you stay on the main river stem, you're probably not going to be bothered. Now, some of the people, there's a lot of private water, private spring creeks that are fairly posted. You have to work to get to those, and that he shouldn't be in.
Okay.
But it's pretty much, and then on the lower river where I'm talking about, it's fairly much Forest Service. There is some private ground, and most of it's posted. But it's not in the same manner. It's a lot more floater-friendly, wader-friendly. But accessing a lot of this stuff is difficult without a boat. You can walk up a few of the levees starting at the Wilson Bridge or starting at South Park. The problem with the snake is that it has a tremendous drop per mile. And what looks like you might be able to wade across, when you start going across it, you're going to get flattened. And so until later September, when the water comes down, you're not going to be able to really move around out there as easily as you would in, say, a lot of other rivers.
Okay, okay. Well, unfortunately, time flies when you're having fun, as always, and we're out of time. But I'd like to ask you if you have a story you could tell us here to end the show. Maybe a unique or fun experience you've had on the snake that we might all enjoy. Can you give us a story?
Well, Roger, I can tell you that I've had some of the most wonderful days of my life on that river, met some of the nicest people. That's the beauty of being a fellow that takes people fishing, is you get to meet people you would never meet in pretty much any other line of work. And some of the very nicest people have just popped up and haven't been famous or anything, but the fellow that helped me get started in moving to Wyoming and has helped me with my fly fishing game is a gentleman you know about named Lefty Cray, and I've known him for an awfully long time, and we'd fished together in a lot of places, but one day he was coming out to do a program for a big Trout Unlimited meeting that we were having in Jackson. And so I had talked to Lefty beforehand, and we were going to go floating after his last talk. And then he had to be back fairly early to do some stuff at the final banquet. So I had everything all set. I zoomed by, picked him up just as he finished his slideshow. We drove up, and we were going to go from Moose to Wilson, which is a pretty long float, but it goes along very quickly. And I was in the process of, we were building our little boat at that time, and we were in the process of changing our oar design. So I had dropped off a set of oars back at the shop and thought I had the oars that I normally used in the car. I got the boat in the water at Moose. Lefty is all set up, ready to go. And I look in the car, and there's no oars. So I thought, well, we'll just run by the shop on the way to town, and we'll do the shuttle ourselves, because I had another truck at the house. Well, you can't believe how confusing a shuttle is on the river to people that have never done it, and Lefty had obviously not done as many shuttles as I thought he had. And so we went by, and I got him to get in my other truck, and he said, well, Paul, I don't know how we're going to do this. I said, Lefty, don't worry about how we're going to do it. Just follow me. So I got him to finally follow me. We dropped the truck off, jumped in the water, and went and floated. Well, if you've ever watched Lefty cast and carry on, he just having a regular relaxing afternoon of fishing is not his style. He's going to throw it around this corner and over this tree and under this rock. And I had just been on that section of river before with some fellows that could barely fish, and the fishing was great. And I said, Lefty, just throw that Adams over there and just let it float. No, I got to show you this one, and I got to show you that one. And all afternoon, the fish just weren't fast enough to get to the fly because it was off again. So there was a fish in that section of river that I mentioned earlier. It's kind of a migratory fish that comes out of Palisades Reservoir that comes back up to the river, and it's like a little steelhead almost. It lives down in the reservoir, and then it comes up, and it's a vagabond-type fish, and it's very strong. It's got bright orange meat, and it eats a lot of shrimp and a lot of plankton down there. And when it hits in the river on this, especially that lower river, it's a hot fish. And I was just dying for Lefty to catch one of these fish because they were so much fun. And some of them hit so hard and abruptly and aggressively that they jump on the way up. So trying to get Lefty to just play it straight was almost impossible, but I think he looked away or something, and one of these fish grabbed that fly before he could show me another trick cast, and it went roaring around. He goes, you know, he says, these are pretty strong. And I was delighted. Finally, we got one, but it was tough. It was a tough afternoon on me, and it was all my fault, of course.
To guide somebody that's very knowledgeable is a lot tougher than to guide somebody that doesn't know anything, I think. Yeah.
Well, I can tell you that you go anywhere with Lefty and the fishing is minor by the fun that you're going to have no matter what's going on.
Well, good story. Well, we are out of time, so we need to move on here, Paul, but stick with me. We're going to give away some good gifts here and stuff, and I need you to help me out, so we'll be right back, folks. We're going to give away that one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine, and that $20 gift certificate to Front Range Anglers. So stick with us. A mining company called Pacrim Coal is planning a massive strip mine near Anchorage, Alaska. The Chuitna Coal Project would be the first project in Alaska history to mine directly through salmon habitat, the Chuitna River drainage, 11 miles of it. Critical commercial, sport, and subsistence fishing economies would be permanently destroyed. Pacrim says it can rebuild a salmon stream, but scientific experts can find no example where successful restoration has occurred after strip mining. Chuitna coal would be shipped to Asia, leaving Alaska with nothing but devastated habitat and ruined salmon runs. It's time to stop the Chuitna coal strip mine. For more information about how you can help, visit www.inletkeeper.org, that's inletkeeper.org, or go to www.trustees.org, trustees.org. But just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section below tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link, leave your comments, we'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away our prizes, and these winners of the drawings are from random selections from our database. You need to have pre-registered for that. It's a little late now, but make sure you do it for our next show and you don't miss out on your chance to win one of these great prizes.
So our first winner, and this is for the one-year membership to Federation of Fly Fishers, is Steve Pyatt in New York. Steve Pyatt. So congratulations, Steve. And I know you'll enjoy your membership. And if you already have one, we'll get it extended for you. And always good to support the FFF. And if you want to learn more about the Federation of Fly Fishers, go to fedflyfishers.org. fedflyfishers.org. And then we've got the one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. This is a great magazine out of Calgary, Canada. Lots of great photography and a lot of great how-tos. I know everybody will enjoy it. And our winner for that is Shane Cavett. Shane Cavett in Texas. So congrats, Shane. I know you'll enjoy that subscription and have fun with it. And now our question and answer session here. And okay, so we were talking before about what Paul, we had a question come in, and Paul described probably what he figured would be the nicest, most finesseful way to fish for cutthroats on the snake. And what kind of fishing was that? What kind of fishing was that? And let's see if that's enough to get me an answer here, Paul. And I got an answer. Paul, what do you think? This answer says dry fly fishing. Would that be it?
I think that would definitely be it. At least that's what I said. Now, whether anybody agrees with that,
well,
I don't know.
But yeah, well, we could change it up and really screw this guy, but we won't. And this is Rick Smith in Richmond. So, Rick, you just got yourself a $20 gift certificate in the Front Range Anglers, and thanks for listening closely to us. So, Rick, just send me your name, address, phone number, email address in the same box that you sent your answer in, and I will get in contact with you and pass that information on to so you can get your gift certificate. And, again, that's with frontrangeanglers.com, frontrangeanglers.com in Boulder, Colorado. So thank you, Front Range, for providing that gift tonight. Congratulations, Rick. Well, Paul, thanks for being with us tonight. It was a pleasure to talk with you, and we could have talked for another couple hours, I'm sure. But time is limited, and, boy, we sure appreciate you taking your time out of your vacation to talk with us.
Roger, I really enjoyed it. There are people, my father included, who say that I'm on vacation all the time. So, but I hope that we've made a case to get some people at least interested in our fish, because I think it's a lot of fun to see a fish that survived a couple million years and is still in there making a case for what we really fondly call our favorite quiet recreation.
Well, and the one
thing
we
didn't, highlighting it.
Yeah, and one thing we didn't talk about at all, but I think that is one of the most beautiful places in the world to be fishing. I know when I drive up from Colorado, we come up, what is it, 191?
Yes.
And then we hit the Snake River and turn right, go up the canyon, and from that point on, it is just gorgeous country. So couldn't get much better, I don't think so.
Well, that
well,
doesn't
that
hurt when fish aren't biting. If it's pretty scenery, people are a little more forgiving of you.
Yeah, yeah. And, boy, there's plenty of nice things to look at there. Well, thanks again, Paul.
Okay, sir.
Our next broadcast will be on April 7th, and that will be 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And on that show, we're going to interview Gary Beulah, and our topic for the show will be kayak fishing in Baja, Mexico. Gary is an expert on fly fishing saltwater from Point Concepcion to Sea of Cortez. He's landed over 130 species on the fly in the salt. And so listen in to learn about Gary's strategies and techniques for fly fishing from a kayak in Baja, Mexico. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Royal Gorge Anglers, Housatonic River Outfitters, and Flats Time Charters for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options to you. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.